Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, we hear from a Clovis woman whose extreme vulnerability to COVID-19 has left her homebound since March. And we catch up with a BuzzFeed reporter we interviewed back in 2018 about her investigation into one of the nation's deadliest serial killers. Her new book describes how the Tulare County native was finally brought to justice. But first, it's hard enough for seasoned teachers to transition from in-person classes to online learning. But what about teachers who are just starting out? FM89's Laura Satsui asked, what's it like for them?
Oscar Andrade left his classroom at Centennial Elementary School in March and was allowed back in early August to get ready for the year. He gave me a tour of it through our Zoom call.
So I'm currently at my desk. This is just a wall where I place different anchor charts. So if they need...
The second year educator moves the laptop around, showing me his library and writing wall, things third graders would probably love to see in person. But for the start of school, they'll see these walls and library as I'm seeing them, through a screen. Andrade says he didn't take online classes in college. It wasn't something he was interested in. So the irony that he has to teach online isn't lost on him, and he's ready to have a lot of patience with the squirreliest of students.
Although it is going to be completely online and I'm not going to have my students in front of me, I am still excited. I'm looking forward to it. At the same time, however, I hate not knowing what the future holds, and I hate not knowing what it's going to be like.
Andrade couldn't put into words what exactly might go wrong, but said he's trying to focus on what he can control. And he did participate in the district's new teacher conference 2 weeks ago. Tracy Taylor, the director of teacher development at Fresno Unified, says it focused on distance learning.
There was a lot of application for them to get practice in what it is that they're going to be doing virtually with their kids. And that's really what we want to do. So not only do we want to give them the resources, but we want to model what that looks like. And every session that we went into, you could feel the excitement still. You could see people's faces of nodding heads and being engaged.
Taylor says she hopes the new teachers have a leg up, since many of them are younger and are used to relying on computers. But teaching through distance learning is still challenging. Jennifer Folsom, a researcher with the educational research group WestEd, has spent years taking online courses to figure out what does and doesn't work.
Some of the instruction that I've been doing in the distance space is truly engaging and inspiring. And that is not something I would have told you was possible in February. So it is possible, but it takes personal experience as a learner to get there.
On the flip side, Folsom adds, districts have to keep minimizing roadblocks. In spring, that meant getting devices and Wi-Fi to families.
And this fall, minimizing roadblocks is thinking carefully about scheduling, about how many hours you have kids in front of a screen watching a Zoom call.
The Fresno Unified schedule includes live instruction and independent learning. The district has also distributed 3,000 hotspots and set up a helpline for families if technology issues come up. That would have been helpful when in-person classes ceased in March, says second grade teacher Lakeisha Miranda.
I know some had tech issues, some didn't have tech. I had a couple who had Fresno Unified tablets, but one had a cracked screen, one didn't have a charger.
Last year was Miranda's first full year at Fresno Unified, and she says most of her second graders didn't stay connected as the spring semester ended, but she's hopeful many of the tech problems have been ironed out.
So I have my whiteboard behind me, and then...
She shows me the corner of her home where she'll teach her upcoming classes. Like Andrade's classroom, she has posters up with sayings and class rules like, do your best and show respect to others.
So I'm hoping starting online now, with the expectations being given that this is running like school, you're expected to be there, there's going to be attendance, and you're expected to work, that will shift the mindset.
She's been having this talk with her own two teenagers.
So you're going to have to get up like regular, be at school by 9 o'clock, and you're on your tablet or on your computer working just like if you were going to school.
Both Miranda and third grade teacher Oscar Andrade say they'd love to be in the classroom with kids, but they also want to stay safe. They have family members who are high risk and would also hate risking their students' health. So for now, they'll teach from a distance, at home and in their classrooms. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
Are you a Fresno Unified parent getting your student ready for school? Or have your kids already started distance learning in another district? We want to hear how it's going. Please leave us a voice memo in our app. It's called KVPR. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, The Guardian published the first in a series of reports on why COVID-19 cases have surged in the Central Valley. I spoke with Vivian Ho, who reported the series, about her investigation into how the virus spread among agricultural workers. Also joining the conversation is UC Merced Associate Professor of Sociology, Edward Flores, who recently co-published a study on the connection between low-wage employment and the spread of the coronavirus.
Vivian, what drew your attention to the Central Valley?
Well, the Central Valley has been just becoming a hot spot in terms of coronavirus infections. A lot of the counties have been on the state's watch list for weeks on end at this point, and they just have not been showing any signs of getting off. The rates at which the infections are happening are almost double of what's happening in the Bay Area, and it's incredibly concerning.
So I'd like to talk specifically about this first story in your series, which starts with the accounts of some agricultural workers in Wasco. What did you hear from the people you interviewed?
What I heard from the workers, and it was from the workers in Wasco, it was from workers in other plants, it was from workers from a lot of different plants all over the Central Valley. And it was the same story, unfortunately. It was that they trusted their companies. They thought their companies would take care of them and would do the right thing for them when the time came, when the situation got worse. They believed that the company would tell them if somebody in their plants got infected. Oh, and a lot of these plants, just by its nature, they work very closely together. It's not built for social distancing. It's right for a spread. And so for a lot of these workers, they were hoping that their companies would do the right thing and tell them when somebody was infected. Unfortunately, they had to find out, a lot of them, through the media, through rumors, through word of mouth, sometimes by getting sick themselves. And it wasn't until it was too late, until there were outbreaks and people were sick by the hundreds, until their families were sick, that they realized that there was a serious problem.
I mean, the headline of your article is everyone tested positive. I mean, what did you hear in terms of the actual spread of COVID-19?
That's where it gets very difficult, because especially with testing. So in the Central Valley Meat Company, the entire production line, according to one worker, tested positive. In other places, in Primex, 151 workers at the last count tested positive. Elsewhere, in the Safeway Distribution Center in Tracy, 51 workers are tested positive. And that's just what we know right now. What we know for sure, though, is that these workers, many of them were not informed until it was too late. They went home. They unknowingly infected their families. Their families then went on to their jobs. They unknowingly infected their co-workers, and now we're in the situation that we're in.
And I mean, there's one in particular heartbreaking story in which a worker exposed the coronavirus to her family. All four of her children tested positive. Is that right?
Yes. All four of her children, including her son, who has asthma, She was incredibly scared, incredibly worried about her son. But in the end, they all came out okay.
So as part of your reporting, you spoke with Edward Flores, associate professor of sociology at UC Merced. And Edward, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. You have done research looking at the relationship between low-wage work and COVID-19. Tell us what you found.
So in our report, we examined American Community Survey data and data from the California Department of Public Health. And we examined the association between COVID-19 positivity rates above 8%, which place a county on the state's watch list, and low-wage work in large households. And what we found was that in those counties that were above the state average with regards to average household size and percentage of households that were low-wage, in those counties, 14 out of 15 were on the state's COVID-19 watch list with positivity rates above 8%. Whereas with the 37 counties that did not meet that criteria, only two of those counties at that time had positivity rates above 8%.
And just, can you put that into perspective for us? I mean, we live in a region where there's a great deal of poverty, and there are, you know, a number of people who are working in these, you know, really low wage jobs. Given what you found, what are the implications for the Valley as a whole as it pertains to the continuing spread of this virus?
Well, the implications to the Valley are that if we fail to cope with the spread of COVID appropriately, then the Valley is going to be much more acutely affected than the rest of the state. Separately from our hidden threat policy brief, separately, we had examined the percentage of essential workers in counties in California and across the nation. And we found that the Valley has some of the highest percentages of their workforce being essential workers in the nation. Madera County, for example, has more than 40% of its employees are essential workers. That ranks third in the nation. Madera, Kings, Tulare, Merced, and Kern are all in the top 10 for counties with the highest percentage of their workforce being frontline essential workers.
Wow, that's staggering. So I want to talk about what the implications are from a policy perspective, but first I'd like to come back to Vivian and hear a little bit more about your reporting on this topic. I assume you reached out, or I know you reached, I read your article, you reached out to the farm operators, owners of these meatpacking plants. What did you hear from them?
Well, they said that they had been practicing CDC guidelines from the start, CDC county and state guidelines from the very beginning at every stage of the pandemic. And this was Primex. This was their spokesman. He was saying that this was happening. According to the workers whom I spoke to, quite a few of them, this was absolutely was not the case. The workers were telling me that they were told from the beginning that masks were not mandatory. If they wanted to wear a mask, they could bring one from home. At one point, Primex was selling a mask for $8 a piece. The social distancing guidelines weren't put in place until well after the outbreak had happened. And just in general, they weren't informing people when infection had arrived. They weren't telling people when they needed to get tested, when they needed to go home, when they needed to be aware of the situation, and when they needed to isolate. When they would ask about when people weren't showing up for work, when they would ask why this person wasn't showing up for work, they would say, oh, this person's on vacation. Oh, this person just, oh, don't worry about it. But they never got a straight answer. And, you know, from the start, that's not what the CDC and not what the state and not what the county says to do.
So assuming that the accounts of the workers are accurate, I mean, how are businesses going to remain operational if you're having COVID wash through their employees in the way that we've seen? Or is it just that from the company's perspective, the workers are expendable?
Unfortunately, that is the attitude that I've perceived from my reporting, that this labor force is essentially expendable, that they're replaceable, essentially. What happened at Primex was, especially when the workers started speaking out, there were layoffs. And Primex said that this was typical of the season, even though it was right in the height of harvesting season and whatnot, they had layoffs and then they rehired people for the same positions. The workers that I spoke to expressed a lot of upset over this. They said they felt like their lives didn't matter. They said they felt like they were nothing, essentially. But the way, unfortunately, what we're seeing right now, I mean, what should have happened from the very beginning is we should have been taking this seriously from the very beginning. Companies should have taken this virus and taken the worker safety and taken precautions from the start. They should have put social distancing guidelines and precautions in back in March. They should have provided masks. They should have provided PPE. They should have provided sick pay. They should have been upfront and clear about that and told workers it's okay that if you're not feeling well, don't come in. That needs to be a clear policy, because if workers don't feel like it's okay to stay home if they're feeling sick, if they don't feel like their jobs are going to be safe if they stay home, then they're going to go to work when they're feeling sick and spread the virus. Unfortunately, we can't go back in time. But what we can do is just make sure that we do this now, especially at plants where the virus hasn't reached yet, or that we don't know of it reaching yet. We got to start doing it now. We got to make sure these practices are in place.
Right. You know, I'd like to come back to you, Ed. What are the policy implications here? What can be done from, let's say, a state or local perspective to learn from the mistakes that were made in the past to ensure that they don't happen again? Because we know this virus is going to be with us for a while.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And the first mistake that we need to learn from is that we assumed that individualistic behavior, individual level behavior, such as wearing a mask and practicing social distancing and not visiting family members, was going to keep our nation safe and flatten the curve. And we need much more than that, the truth is, because as long as we want to eat every day, the food is going to get on our table somehow. And that's going to involve a certain amount of work in which people are in proximity with each other and can't simply Zoom as middle-class workers can. So we need to be a lot more deliberate about focusing, learning more about where these outbreaks are happening, and developing policies that mitigate the spread among those types of workers, instead of what we have right now, which is policies largely in place that protect middle-class workers and assume that individual-level behavior will prevent the virus from spreading amongst everyone else.
So, Vivian, this is just the first in a series of reports that you have coming out focused on COVID-19 in the Central Valley. What else are you looking at? What can we expect in the future?
I have a piece coming out hopefully within the next couple of days, maybe the next week or so. That's going to be looking at how politics and policy making has led to the moments that we're in right now. And then after that, I'm going to be looking at the outbreak at Avenal State Prison and how the prison ecosystem in the Central Valley has led to the surge in coronavirus cases.
Fascinating. Well, we certainly look forward to reading those. Before we wrap up, though, Edward, I'd like to give you the last word. As a sociologist, you have been researching inequities in our system for a long time. And certainly what we're seeing in the Central Valley is that the conditions that many people are experiencing have exacerbated the spread of this disease. And so this is a question that I've asked other sociologists, other academics, and I want to ask you as well. Do you think, and it's slightly different from what I asked you before, but do you think in general this moment will help us as a society recognize the cost of these inequities and as a result make some lasting sort of systemic changes to create a more equitable society? I mean, do you think this could be a tipping point for the way we think about our shared responsibility to one another as a society?
I do think that this moment can be a tipping point. When we look at great upheavals or economic disasters that have happened in the past, they've been associated with major changes in our policies. And for example, the New Deal came about as a result of the Great Depression. And many of the benefits that we enjoy today, such as Social Security, came about as a result of the New Deal. Unfortunately, the New Deal left out a lot of workers, agricultural workers, domestic workers, jobs that were done by largely Black and Brown persons. So this pandemic, as devastating as it is a moment in which we may begin to see some changes addressing workers from communities that are furthest on the margins. And if we want to be optimistic, right now more than ever is the time when we may see changes in the system that people have been advocating for many decades now. I think our society faces a reckoning over the costs of low-wage work, not just to those workers themselves, but to the rest of us. And there are specifically some measures that are happening at the state level that I think indicate a renewed response towards addressing the conditions of those workers that are furthest on the margins. Specifically, there's the Safety Net for All Coalition, which is comprised of over 125 of the state's largest community immigrant rights and worker organizations. They have been advocating for wage replacement. And just recently, the state legislature's joint stimulus proposal highlighted wage replacement for undocumented workers as one of their priorities. If this passes, this would be historic. It would be the first time that that unemployment benefits were extended specifically to undocumented workers. And there's also state bills right now that are in the process of gaining support, which would expand paid sick and family leave provisions for all workers. And finally, the Office of Safety and Health Standards Board is about to make a decision on an emergency COVID-19 temporary standard, which for months was something that hadn't been discussed, but now under pressure from advocates may be passed. And so we see several changes happening in the short term addressing COVID, but at the same time, more broadly addressing the needs of the most disadvantaged workers in ways that our public wasn't coalescing around previous to the pandemic.
Could I add something, Edward, here?
Absolutely.
So we're talking about shared responsibility here. And I think what's really important to keep in mind with all this is that I feel like too often than not, even within this pandemic, we look at these situations and we look at these stories and we think to ourselves, well, it's not happening to me. It's not happening in my world. It's not happening in my apartment. It's not happening to my friends. So it doesn't affect us. Like, yes, these outbreaks are happening. Yes, this virus is happening, but it's happening to these low-wage workers. That's awful, but it's not happening to us. But what I think this pandemic has laid bare for all of us is that we are much more interconnected than we all thought we were. This is not happening in a silo. These workers that are catching this virus, they live in our cities. They live in our communities. They are going home to their families that live in the same houses as them. Their families are working in the restaurants that you frequent, that you're going to, that you are fighting for being able to dine in right now. It's all interconnected, and their conditions, their working conditions affect you just as much as it affects them.
Well, that's a great point to end on. Vivian Ho, West Coast reporter for The Guardian, and Edward Flores, Associate Professor of Sociology at UC Merced. Thank you so much for your good work.
Thank you for having us on the show.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock.
A global pandemic like COVID-19 can be risky for anyone, but the risk level is at a totally different scale for Rachel Goldring Bell. Born with congenital heart disease, she was later diagnosed with a lung disease and an immune disorder. Here's an audio postcard of the 27-year-old student's experience of sheltering in place in Clovis with her husband, her parents, two cats, and two dogs.
Can you give me a hand bringing in the groceries from Costco?
My mom's the only one that can go out.
Okay, so let's get the frozen stuff first.
So when she comes home, my mom will strip down into the garage, and then she will go shower immediately. Then Jake will start bleaching everything down, even the vegetables and the fruit.
I got the bleach.
And we will leave it in the sun to dry as soon as they're ready and clean. I will put them away with gloves and a mask on just in case. And then my husband will bleach my mom's car keys, purse, wallet, credit cards, phone, anything that she's touched or used. That will take about an hour. Sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more.
Here, which ones are dirty?
They're all dirty except these. My two diseases that I would probably say would put me most at risk would be pulmonary hypertension and common variable immunodeficiency. Together, it's a disaster, but then as my congenital heart disease, which is pretty severe, I don't know if I would survive. I doubt I would survive. And I'm usually always quarantined during winter anyway. I still wear a mask when I do things out during cold and flu. People would stare at me as if I was an alien, where, you know, people are, is she a germaphobe, or is she doing it for attention, or, you know, is she doing it as a fashion statement? Because I've gotten all those questions. And now I find it hilarious that everyone else is wearing masks as well. Now it's normal. Now it's the new normal.
I'm going to go get more paper towels.
The first week of March, my husband Jake and I, we were going to meet my sister in Disneyland, and we got back that weekend, and my dad said, brace yourself, you're not leaving the house. And I just looked at him like, okay, you've got to be kidding. Like, this isn't happening. So I really thought it was going to be like a week. I thought I could still go to the grocery store, you know, with a mask on. I still thought I'd be able to leave. I did not think it was going to be house arrest for 100 plus days.
Oh, I cleaned out the refrigerator.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
So it was really hard in the beginning, and it's still hard some days. But I came up with a routine. So in the morning, I wake up at 7 o'clock, take my meds, go back to sleep for 30 minutes, get up, feed the dogs, take them out, move my oxygen so I can go upstairs to work out. I do Zwift, which is a virtual cycling program, and they do competitions that I've done too in this quarantine. And so it's really fun. I'll do 12 miles on the bike, but I'll have to stop a lot because I can't breathe, or I have to wait for my lungs to inflate. I come downstairs, drink 40 ounces of water, make my lunch. Yeah, this is sad. This is what brings me joy. My life starting again depends on a vaccine. It sucks. It's like putting my life in someone else's hands yet again. And that's what kind of makes me feel like it is the ICU. It feels like a form of ICU psychosis, because in the ICU, I was only allowed in my room. And so I would go psychotic, because I could not leave my room. I almost feel like we're living in someone else's reality. And so I'm angry that it spread the way it did. I'm angry that I can't meet my nephew that was just born. I can't see my sister. I mean, that sucks. It's a very helpless feeling. But on the other hand, I understand that we can't start our lives again, because this is so deadly for me. And I also feel guilt that, you know, if it weren't for me, my parents probably wouldn't be this. It wouldn't be to the extent that it is right now. Living with my parents is a huge blessing, because if we were doing this by ourselves, there would be a lot more anxiety with it. when we get to go to the grocery store and not have to bleach down every little thing, it's going to be a very happy day.
You got Gouda?
For you.
OMG, we got to get that out of the sun fast.
That was Rachel Goldring Bell of Clovis, and her concerns about COVID-19 beg the question, who is more at risk of severe infection? Here to answer that question and more is FM89 health reporter Carrie Klein with our weekly COVID-19 update. Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Hi, Kathleen.
So we heard from Rachel Goldring Bell and her worries about what could happen if she's exposed to the virus. What do we know about risk factors for severe infection?
Well, so there are two short answers that probably most of us have heard already. Age is a risk factor. The older you get, the more at risk you are. And then there's ethnicity. People of color appear to be more at risk than whites. But there's this whole other category of those with underlying conditions. We hear the term comorbidities. Those are the other conditions that show up alongside COVID-19 in the same person. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have a list of comorbidities that have been reported among people with severe disease. And those conditions with the highest amount of evidence, they include diseases affecting the heart, lungs, kidneys, as well as obesity, diabetes, their compromised immune systems, like Rachel that we heard from earlier, and there are a handful of other diseases as well. There are many other conditions that likely make people susceptible to severe disease, but there isn't enough information to know just yet. If you want more information, you can click through all of this on the CDC website.
Well, how does the CDC know all of this?
So there have actually been a ton of scientific studies that have been published examining COVID-19, and they're in all sorts of different groups of people. Some are from just individual hospitals, some from regions or countries. I mean, scientists around the world are trying to tackle this and answer questions as quickly as they can. And on the CDC webpage, where they list all of this information, they actually point to 90 reports that contributed to the information they have on the website. So you can actually read the primary sources if you want to. And also, I do want to define one thing as well. And what we're talking about here is who's more at risk of severe infection. But if you want to know who's just at risk of getting the disease in the first place, I don't think we know enough to answer that question. We're just kind of looking at who's at risk for, you know, the disease actually getting to be pretty bad.
Fair enough. So everything you've said so far is what health officials know at a national level. What if we drill down locally?
So local data, unfortunately, are really hard to come by. Fresno is the only county in the San Joaquin Valley that has put together any sort of analysis of comorbidities and posted it publicly. They published a report based on the first 138 deaths in the county. That's a pretty small data set. So, you know, that has to be the disclaimer here. But it's all that we have, we as the public have right now. And of those 138 deaths, half of them were over 75 years old, and almost two-thirds were Hispanic. And if we talk about comorbidities, three-quarters of those 138 who died had comorbidities of some sort. And among those, diabetes and hypertension were most common. There were also some lung, kidney, and cardiovascular diseases. But of course, this data set was only among those who have died, not those who ended up in the hospital or the ICU. That would be a much broader and more precise data set, but that is a ton of information to gather on people that county health officials don't necessarily have the bandwidth for. Kern County also has not made their comorbidity data publicly available, but they shared verbally with me that obesity, hypertension, and diabetes are also their most common comorbidities.
Thank you for that. Now let's zoom out to the regional update you give us every week.
Right. Okay. So last week we talked about a data backlog in the state disease reporting system. This was a pretty big bombshell. But state health officials announced earlier this week that the backlog on their end has been settled and fixed. However, counties are still sorting through their data to make sure they're not missing any important numbers. So everything is still a little bit up in the air. Locally, our case numbers appear to be settling a little bit. So do hospitalization and ICU rates. So that could be good news. But county officials I've heard from this week say it's tough to know if this is really a permanent trend, especially given the statewide data snafu. And then when it comes to deaths due to COVID-19, those have not slowed in the last few weeks locally, but fatalities typically lag behind some of those other data factors anyway, even if those others are improving. And I'm also going to put out a call that I'm hearing from health officials over and over and over again. If you've recovered from the disease, please donate your blood. You've got antibodies that might help others survive the disease.
And have there been any developments in individual counties that we should know about?
Right. So here's a quick rundown. In Fresno County, county supervisors announced a partnership with community benefit organizations. They're distributing $5.5 million to 17 organizations, and that will bring on a few hundred additional contact tracers and will also bolster outreach among at-risk groups like Black, immigrant, and refugee communities. County health officials also reported earlier this week that more than 400 businesses have had at least one case of coronavirus among its staff, but the county is not revealing which businesses those are. So that's in Fresno. In Kern, there's been a small outbreak so far at the Mesa Verde ICE detention facility in Bakersfield. That's still developing. My colleague Madi Bolaños has been following that. You can find her work online. In Kings County, Avenal State Prison still remains the state prison with the second highest cumulative case count. It's now up to 1,500, and five of those men have died. In Merced County, they reported a record high total of daily new cases on Monday. Cases are always higher on Mondays in Merced because they don't report over the weekend, but this was still the highest Monday report that they've had. In Tulare County, the military health workers that had been deployed to Cahuilla Delta Medical Center have been granted an extension and will stay until the end of August. That's good news. And extensions are being worked on for those healthcare workers in Fresno and Kings counties as well. And then in Madera and Mariposa, new cases continue to be reported, though in Mariposa, at least, it's only at a slow trickle.
Well, Carrie, as always, thank you so much for the update.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A year ago, Jose Manuel Martinez, a Tulare County native, was facing 10 life terms in prison before a trial in Florida that could have resulted in the death penalty. But Martinez was spared and given another life sentence. He confessed to killing 36 people over the course of 30 years as an assassin for hire. Many of those murders took place in the Central Valley, where he went by the moniker El Mano Negra, the Black Hand. His crimes are the subject of a new book by BuzzFeed Investigations editor Jessica Garrison called The Devil's Harvest. FM89's Laura Satsui spoke to Garrison about what it's like to tell the story of Martinez, a deadly serial killer who evaded police for years before they brought him to justice.
We interviewed you back in 2018 when your BuzzFeed piece came out, and that was sort of tracing, to some extent, the life of Jose Manuel Martinez from his first kill to avenge the death of one of his sisters to when he was finally caught. So talk about what happened between publishing that piece and now publishing your book.
I wrote a lot of words is the short answer. I think when I wrote that piece, as long as it was, I felt like it really had only scratched the surface of the story, because the piece was a lot about his life. But I quickly realized that, what drew me to the story in the first place was, both that it's a crazy story, but also the question of how did he get away with this? Why was he allowed to get away with this? Why did, we as people in California allow this person to kill with impunity and, not find a way to stop it? When I finished the BuzzFeed piece, one of the things that became clear to me was that part of the answer to that question lay in sort of the place where he was from and the history of the place where he was from and the history of his life in that place where he was from, namely the southern part of the San Joaquin Valley. And that there was that also, it was just an incredibly rich story. I mean, just about every person who touched this story had their own story that they brought to it. And each of them were just incredible. So that's, part of why I was like, there's a little bit more here. Off we went.
And then I know, in 2019 was sort of when he was getting charged and sentenced with various things. Can you talk a little bit about where he is now?
So he, his story sort of first came onto my radar in 2014, which is when Alabama announced that they were extraditing him to California, or California announced that they were extraditing him from Alabama to face charges on 9 murders in California. Since that time, he's pled guilty to a murder in Alabama, to 9 murders in California, and then Florida tried to give him the death penalty. And so he was adjudicated on 2 murders in Florida. He was convicted, was not given the death penalty, and is now in prison.
And as you mentioned, I mean, your book points out that part of why he got away with it is to some extent various failings of local law enforcement. They were so close to catching him and they, you know, knew he was around, but he got away so many times. And so can you talk about why it took a murder in Alabama to get him to confess?
The facts are what the facts are. Like, he was a named suspect numerous times, never charged. The reasons for that are complicated. There are certainly a lot of detectives who did work these cases hard. You know, what happened in Alabama is that he committed a murder of someone who was sort of loosely connected to his daughter. And his daughter, who was not involved in any criminal activity whatsoever, got, you know, sort of police came into her orbit, and her father was like, oh my gosh, I don't want, you know, her. I mean, they weren't going to charge her. They knew she was innocent, but, you know, I think he came back from Mexico, you know, he left California, went briefly to Mexico, and then came back to Alabama and confessed.
And as you mentioned, I mean, one thing I really did enjoy about this book was that you wove in sort of the overarching narrative of, like, the negligence of the community of Early Mart by the Tulare County Board of Supervisors / like Tulare County as a municipality. And I'm wondering, and you mentioned a couple different stories of, like, people deciding they need to organize in order to get things done, in order to hold farmers accountable for pesticide drift, or to say, like, we really need a park or a pool for this community. And so, I mean, was there, in doing your research, a moment where you were like, this belongs, I really need to show sort of the uprising of some of the people in this community? Why did you decide to include that?
I mean, I think for a couple reasons. First of all, because Early Mart's an interesting place, right? It during a lot of the period of this book, the population was about 4,000. Now I think it's about 8,000. It's not rich. It's quite poor. It suffers from a lot of the problems that plague a lot of communities in the Valley. You know, they just, for example, lost their water during a pandemic pretty recently and are now drinking, you know, then another well was brought on and now they've got water that's got some level of contamination. So it's got sort of all the issues of it. It's also a very tight-knit community. And it's a community where over and over people have said, you know what? No. And so the book highlights 2 examples of that. You know, one is in the early 80s, there was just a spate of murders in Early Mart. And then I saw an article about a peace march and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, because it's a small town, you could track down people involved in that peace march. And I found a couple people who were like, yes. And then we decided we need a park, but we couldn't get one and we needed a pool. So we decided, you know, I think one of the people was like, we're going to get a pool if I have to dig it myself. That's kind of extraordinary. And then in the late 90s, somebody kind of gassed a great deal of the town. And it, you know, there are a lot of people around who remember that, and it was terrible. I mean, this sort of, you know, smell or something comes wafting over the town and all of a sudden people are coughing and they call the fire department and the fire department, you know, doesn't know what it is. And, you know, does the exact wrong thing, which is that they're like, we're going to spray everybody. So they make everybody take off their clothes in the middle of the street and spray them. And the problem is, that was not the right thing to do. A woman named Teresa de Anda just sort of took that in Early Mart and then went from town to town to town and was like, you don't have to put up with this. And, you know, that was important to me because I think part of the story is about how the civic institutions of the Valley treat these towns that in some ways they're not even towns, like they're not incorporated. They're communities, but they don't have any power. They don't have any economic power. They don't have any social power, and they don't have any even like sort of civic or government power. And showing how people reacted to that in different ways felt really important to me.
One thing I kept thinking about is how the story you heard from law enforcement and the story of like who he is from his family are totally different. He he was almost like, one thing I thought of was he was almost like a Robin Hood for his family. Like, he kind of had this moral code of, like, people he killed, he often believed were really bad people, and he didn't kill their families. He just went after the person he was told to go after. And he also said that he liked killing, but then when his family talks about him, they say he was so loving. And I don't know, how did you ever reconcile these two stark descriptions of one person? Did it, like, make sense to you?
No. Short answer. I mean, you know, I think it's you know, when you hear his family talk about him, which, you know, I've seen them, you know, in conversation, and then I've seen them, you know, in a witness stand under oath talking about him. And they paint a portrait, which, you know, of a person who is just, like, the most caring. I mean, you know, some of the stories are, like, just astonishing, the lengths to which he went to be supportive of his family and to be there for his family. And then, you know, he was also, and, you know, he freely admits this, like, a vicious killer. And I don't know that I've encountered, you know, I mean, I've asked law enforcement, I've asked members of his family, you know, nobody has an explanation for that. And, you know, I think to some extent I made a decision in the book that, like, you know, I'm not a forensic psychologist. I'm not a psychologist. And to me, the more sort of pressing question for those of us who, you know, aren't members of his family isn't so much like, why is he like this? It is, you know, why did this happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we have to leave it there, but we've been talking to Jessica Garrison, an investigations editor for BuzzFeed and author of a new book, The Devil's Harvest, which you can find online and purchase there. Jessica, thank you for writing this book and for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Violinist Anjali Makaronis recently graduated from University High School in Fresno and will be attending Harvard this fall from home. You may have heard her perform this spring on Valley Public Radio's Young Artist Spotlight or as a guest on our Play On series earlier this summer. Valley Public Radio's David Ouse recently caught up with her to learn more about her Little Virtuosos project and the interconnection between music and mental health.
That's music of Shostakovich performed by Fresno violinist Anjali Makaronis with two of her friends from San Francisco Conservatory of Music pre-college program, violinist Pierce Wang and pianist Charlotte Wong, both of whom are guest collaborators in Anjali's Little Virtuosos project. You're attending Harvard, but you will not be heading to Cambridge right now. Is that correct?
Yeah, I will be having all my classes online, so I'll just be here at home.
You've been making good use of your summer, and that's what we want to talk about, is your Little Virtuosos project. Tell us a little bit about the mission of the Little Virtuosos project.
Sure. So Little Virtuosos project is a student-led initiative that I created in the fall of 2018, and it originally started out as a string quartet and a vocalist playing at Evangel Home, which is a homeless shelter in downtown Fresno. And so we would play there. But since we're also interested in how music affects the brain and how we can relate it to, like, mental health awareness and other issues such as that, we really wanted our mission to be connecting music and mental health awareness and educating the public about how music and neuroscience intertwine. So that's what we've been doing for the past couple of weeks. We've been trying to transition to a more virtual kind of presence. So we've been more active on social media, on Instagram, and we just launched a website just to reach a much wider audience, especially during this time.
So who are your main collaborators in the Little Virtuosos project?
We started out, a couple of friends and I, from University High School. So we have a string quartet, cello, viola, another violinist, and we have a vocalist who also attended University High School. And they'll be attending different universities, so UC Berkeley and UOP and the University of Notre Dame. And since then, we've really expanded a lot to actually different countries. So I have a couple of friends who live in Taiwan and another who lives in New Zealand. So we've been able to collaborate a lot on these different projects, and they're really talented musicians.
That's super cool. And am I right in guessing that it's the constraints of not doing stuff in person made you to figure out different ways to connect online? And so that probably led to these international collaborations that you might not have done otherwise?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we were actually just talking about it because we actually just released a new member form, like an application to have more people collaborate on music videos and do a lot of research and stuff like that. So we've had applicants from around the country and around the world, different countries. So it's been really great to just use this time to be able to connect with people even more, even though it may not be in person. So it's just been a really great way to kind of bridge those gaps that we have during this pandemic.
One of your latest videos is tied in with Black, Indigenous, Persons of Color Mental Health Awareness Month. What's the song and how did you pick it?
So the song is called I Have Nothing by Whitney Houston. And I've actually loved this song ever since I first heard it. So I really wanted to incorporate it somehow into our project. And it was actually in the first week of July, I was just looking through Instagram and I just saw this post about how it was Black, Indigenous, and People of Color's Mental Health Awareness Month. We were like, oh, we should create a series where we highlight different BIPOC artists and musicians and play some of their works. So I Have Nothing is part of that series that we created to highlight BIPOC artists' stories and just how they came into the music world.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
There's nowhere else.
Members of the Little Virtuoso Project performing a voice and string quartet version of Whitney Houston's I Have Nothing. Well, we certainly wish you a lot of luck in school, and it's great what you're doing with the website, and wish all of your collaborators a great semester as they move on to the next stage of education. For our listeners, can you remind me, what's the name of your website?
Our website is called littlevirtuososproject.org.
Anjali Makaranis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.